The Infectious Disease Society of America certainly has a number of guidelines. And back in 2020 and 2021, they worked on an antimicrobial gram-negative, antimicrobial-resistant gram-negative infection guideline. It was recently updated in 2023, just a few months ago. And certainly the key for that is that there's been some nice updates there. And really, I think there's been a few highlights, which I've really liked in these new updates. One is they do a really nice job of having a distinction between urinary and non-urinary source infections and the importance of really the non-urinary source infections probably needing higher dose, prolonged therapy, and more specific antimicrobials than the urinary tract infections, where we can actually get away with certain antimicrobials that might have borderline MICs or other classes which we may not use for bloodstream infections, for example. So I think they do a nice job of highlighting that. Number two, they do a really nice job of highlighting the importance of really managing the Enterobacter alis, or the CREs associated with the Enterobacter alis family. This may actually be both carbapenem resistant and ESBL producing Enterobacter alis that are not carbapenem resistant. But the importance that, for example, these agents or these bugs might be susceptible to things such as cefepime, piperacillin, tazobactam, but that their outcomes may not necessarily be successful. So really that role of carbapenems in the ESBL producing Enterobacter alis and that cornerstone of the IDSA recommendations was much stronger this time around. And I think that's very important for a lot of us critical care physicians, where we have to treat these patients empirically. We might get a beautiful little S, for example, next to piperacillin, tazobactam, but we might not necessarily see that clinical success. And I think that was key and important. Number three is really around Acinetobacter baumannii and the real need for Amsulbactam and high-dose Amsulbactam as a cornerstone for therapy for non-urinary tract infections with Acinetobacter. And really that is going to be the cornerstone in dual therapy, particularly in bloodstream and respiratory infections with Acinetobacter. And really the role that Amsulbactam and particularly that that activity of sulbactam against Acinetobacter is very important in those cases. And I think those are three highlights that have really played a very nice role. And we've certainly seen those become more prominent in a 2023 reiteration, which I think is key, particularly in our ICU population. When we talk about how these updates are implemented, my institution at UC Davis, I think I can say fairly is it's an ongoing struggle. So, one of the main implementations we have, and really this is on our end, when we look at antimicrobial stewardship, we've really focused on many of the updates, particularly again, as I mentioned, around urinary tract versus non-urinary tract infections, is one mainstay. And then looking at how we make particular changes within the Enterobacter alis family, that's mostly been done on the stewardship side. We have not made, based on these guidelines, wholesale adopted practices, except in one area, I think, which I'll mention in a second. But we haven't really made whole-scale practice changes yet. But as a stewardship group, we've really adopted many of those changes. Now, I think the first one, again, is to look at urinary tract infections and urinary system infections separate from other area infections. That is definitely one. Number two, which I think the guidelines highlight nicely, is that for more serious infections involving ESBL-producing organisms that are susceptible to carbapenems, that carbapenems are the preferred treatment of choice. So if this is a bloodstream infection, for example, or a deep space infection that's not urinary, it may be susceptible to cefepime, it may be susceptible to piperacillin, tazobactam. If it is one of those Enterobacter alis, really based on the Moreno study and other studies, and the guidelines had a nice explanation for those, is really to focus on using carbapenems. That is one area where we're really trying to educate a lot of our providers, particularly in the ICU, where the patients may be unstable and time is of the essence. So that role for empiric therapy and empiric carbapenem therapy is important. On the flip side is we don't want to engender any more resistance with our gram-negatives. So when we don't need a carbapenem, such as those urinary tract sites, that we're going to really de-escalate quickly there. So I think those are updates are being implemented, but it's really a lot of us on the pharmacy and the stewardship side, making sure our physicians know how to manage those differences and really help guide them. We don't really, again, have larger policy around that, except when we are looking at, for example, a E. coli coli or a Klebsiella that has is carrying a CTX gene, we're really not going to look at using cefepime, piperacillin, tazobactam, or, you know, obviously not ceftriaxone because they'll already be resistant. That MICs don't necessarily correlate to clinical success, and that in many of these cases, a carbapenem is going to be a mainstay. So some of that is really our education, and that's probably one area where it's gone outside of our stewardship. I think the 2023 update for resistant gram-negative infections, there are a couple areas where I think we're really going to change how I treat patients, and really the mainstay. One is, you know, as we mentioned before, really this highlight for ESBL production. So really this highlight for ESBL production, that really staying away from cefepime and piperacillin tazobactam for bloodstream infections, for other deep-seated infections in unstable patients is really key. We have been, as many places around the country have, we have been really focused on carbapenem sparing therapy as much as humanly possible. But there are carve-out areas, such as a critically ill patient where we are, you know, going to have a potential bloodstream infection with an Enterobacter alis-based organism that could carry the CTX gene, where carbapenem therapy up front is really key and important. So I think that's one area where therapy is going to change much more directly. The second big area is around Acinetobacter. And while we do have a moderate amount of Acinetobacter at my institution, and particularly our carbapenem-resistant Acinetobacter-Baumannii complex group has declined over time, we're still seeing in certain pockets within our hospital that our rates remain high, burn unit, for example. And that really having ampicillin sulbactam as the cornerstone of therapy and high dose ampicillin sulbactam between 6 and 9 grams per day is really going to be a mainstay of therapy. So we have not, while we've done that more regularly and we've had our ID consult involved, I think that's been a practice that we are not perfect with. So really making sure that those patients with Acinetobacter, number one, have amp sulbactam as a mainstay of therapy. And number two, that dual therapy is going to play a much bigger role in many of those infections. Again, if it's isolated to the urinary tract, we may be able to get away with lesser agents that are not going to be as broad or may not be successful in a bloodstream infection. We may get away with monotherapy, but dual coverage with amp sulbactam as the cornerstone, I think, is not readily practiced at our institution and may not be at many other institutions. And I think that's something is a big take home that we're certainly going to look at, in addition to focusing on the other things I mentioned with carbapenems. The changes that the IDSA guidelines have come up with, particularly the changes around management for Acinetobacter baumannii, have changed some of our treatment decisions. So, and I think there's two areas. One, Acinetobacter baumannii treatment decisions have changed. And then I think number two, when we look at the metallo-beta-lactamase space, I think that has really changed to a degree as well. The first thing I think with our Acinetobacter baumannii, you know, certainly, you know, when we have a carbapenem-resistant isolate, really having that ampicillin sulbactam as the mainstay and the cornerstone of therapy is going to be really important. And that's one big area where my treatment decisions are going to be changed in that regard. Number two, which when we look at the NDMs, and particularly when you're looking at, you know, or a metallo-beta-lactamase such as an NDM, a MIM, and so forth, really that combination, the recommendations are to use sufentanil or a combination that's going to, for example, as Trianam plus Avibactam. So if you're going to use Ceftaz, Avibactam, and as Trianam, I think that addition of Avibactam is key in certainly providing some treatment with the NDMs, and particularly likewise with if it's an OXA 48 or some of the more advanced OXAs, which provide high resistance, those class D ESBLs. I think really having the mainstay of ceftazidine avibactam as highlighted in the guidelines, and that's a newer change, is really going to play a much bigger role. We've had a nice cornerstone at our institution for having ceftaz avibactam play a role in both pseudomonal infections as well as serine carbapenemase infections with Enterobacter alis. That's been there for years, and I don't think that's going to change. But really looking at the NDM and the potential class D, Ambler class D OXA 48s, you know, really having that be also mainstay of therapy with, you know, an avibactam containing compound is going to be a key update. This discussion in the IDSI guidelines of treating patients empirically is always fraught with danger. And but it's fraught with certainly having important adjudication and risk management. So I think what the guidelines did a nice job of explaining, and this wasn't so much in the executive summary, but kind of in the meat of the guidelines, is, you know, when you have patients who have high risk potential for having carbapenem resistant or a highly resistant gram negative, that treating these patients with some of those broad agents empirically, it may be a carbapenem in the case where they may have a, you know, potentially a CTX, or it may be that if they're going to be, you know, have a serine carbapenemase or an NDM, to treat empirically in those cases, I think is key. And again, that's somewhere where, as an ID physician or potentially as a PharmD that works in this space regularly, we think about these things, but I think the average critical care physician doesn't always. So again, the guidelines really highlighted a couple areas for empiric high risk for carbapenem resistance, and that treating them empirically with something for carbapenem resistance is key. One is if they've had a prior culture in the last 6 months. Number two is that in the last 30 days, they've had multiple courses of antimicrobials, which obviously many of our patients will have in our ICU. And number three is, what is your local antibiogram? So that link in the guide, in the guidance from the IDSA, with your local antibiogram and potential empiric treatment, I think was key. Where we sort of run into this, we may, for example, at our institution here at UC Davis, we know what our antibiogram is in particular ICUs, burn unit, medical ICU, for example, but we don't always know what our antibiogram is in our surrounding facilities. So if we accept a transfer from another facility, if they're coming from a skilled facility, that is a little something that I think we need to do a bit better with. And the guidance sort of highlighted that your antibiogram is not only your institutions, but it's also what's within your region, particularly when you get transfers or bounce backs from some skilled facilities or long-term facilities. I think that's really, I think that's really key to really focusing on that empiric therapy, and to know what that risk is and start out. Again, there's also the value in cultures, that when those cultures come back, if they don't carry that resistance, we can always de-escalate, and they do a nice job of highlighting that as well. And, you know, that common sense of stepping down to the least common denominator of therapy. But really, they did a nice job of talking about the risk factors and that need for covering those things up front, particularly if they're clinically unstable. Polymicrobial infections have always been a moving target. And we know, for example, particularly some of the recommendations with multi-drug resistant organisms around pulmonary polymicrobial infections or other intra-abdominal and deep space infections, they're the most likely to have more than one organism. When we see, for example, a ventilator-associated pneumonia that's going to have a highly resistant gram negative, there are other potentials there. So again, in polymicrobial infections, if it's suspected, you're going to treat obviously for all, and you're going to treat for that agent that's going to have the most resistance. And where that sort of becomes a bit of a challenge is if you're going to look at some of the agents that are potentially carbapenem non-susceptible, you may not have that anaerobic coverage that you have with meropenem or piperacillin tazobactam. So, really covering broadly and making sure that you're going to actually potentially get anaerobes as well as Staph aureus in those cases, I think is certainly key. They did a nice job of sort of highlighting, again, in those polymicrobial spaces, if you can reduce that isolated coverage for the non-resistant gram negatives, for example, Staph aureus, and you think it's MSSA because their MRSA screening test was negative, that you also de-escalate as well. But I think the newer recommendations are polymicrobial infections are certainly real, cover broadly, and for the most highly resistant potential infection in those spaces. And then lastly, the two areas which were more in the meat of the process with polymicrobial infections, one, which there's another IDSA guidance recently, is that for extended infusion for beta-lactams and cephalosporins and carbapenems, that's going to really be key and certainly help in these polymicrobial spaces, is to, you know, have an extended infusion, number one, which I think is certainly very important. And then number two is source control, which certainly played a role in some of these spaces. Again, in the lung, a little bit harder, but for example, if it's an intra-abdominal infection or bloodstream infections related to something that needs source control, I think that's key. So ID Week 2023, which is ID Week, is always a great meeting, wonderful to go to. And unfortunately, this year I didn't get a chance to fully go due to a conflict with another meeting, which is a little bit of a bummer. And I think there were a number of different abstracts that were very nice. you know, that sort of came out. Many of them looked at successive treatment. But I think one sort of general theme, and I'll just mention there were a few different poster sessions around this, but more particularly one poster session highlighted antimicrobial resistant mechanisms. And, you know, what we see is that, and I think the key takeaway from this and multiple other studies was that, you know, our MIC data doesn't, from cultures, sort of can conflict very frequently with two things. One is molecular testing, and number two is really clinical success. So, you know, we may see that there's an increased success of carbapenem non-susceptibilities or multi-drug resistant isolates, particularly by molecular testing, but we don't necessarily see clinical failures when we're on a drug that we would expect it to be resistant to. Secondly, is we can see that a number of those MICs may show that they're susceptible, but more importantly, that we don't actually get clinical success all the time. And I think that's really kind of goes back to some of the earlier discussions we just had now with empiric therapy and knowing what people are at risk for. So it, you may have, for example, susceptibility to piperacillin tazobactam or to you know, other agents, but you're not going to see that clinical success, particularly in bloodstream infections with multiple classes. And I think that was highlighted with a number of different poster sessions. Number two, which I think we sort of got to here, was that while we have a lot of nice options for some of these novel gram-negative agents, and Jeffrey Stritch highlighted this in one of his oral abstracts, and there were a few other abstracts as well, that uptake in many of our hospitals has been relatively sluggish and slow. And it's not that the resistance is not there. It's sort of this weird contradictory issue. You can see that lots of data show that ESBLs are on the rise, multi-drug resistant gram negatives are on the rise. We're seeing them much more frequently. There were a number of posters looking at metallo-beta-lactamase production and trends in metallo-beta-lactamase surveillance studies within the United States. But we don't really see that our hospitals are taking these up, these agents up. And that's a really complex process. I think it was very nicely highlighted that stewardship has played a very big role, but that many physicians still are uneducated about the role of some of these novel agents and are still uneducated about where they best fit, which is why the 2023 update on the IDSA guidelines for gram negatives is so important, because it really sort of highlights, you know, there are multiple newer novel agents for gram-negative therapy, and they fit exactly here in bloodstream infections, in deep space infections, where we're seeing carbapenem non-susceptibility. And this is exactly where we want to use them empirically. Here are the risk factors for using these empirically when you don't have the cultures back. And I think that education and that lacking knowledge among many physicians, particularly non-ID physicians, I think was very nicely highlighted in those studies.